Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and Bart Zielinski makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Anne and I met Bart when we were in London recently and thought he was well equipped to make a presentation here tonight on the topic of the outbreak of the Great War in the South Pacific, Germany versus the Allies. I'll introduce him briefly. He's the PhD scholar at the Menzies Centre for Australian Studies at King's College in London. He's done an MA in history at Royal Holloway at the University of London, and he's currently working, among other things, on a history for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade on the First World War and the Australian-UK relationship. So many thanks, Bart, and we look forward to hearing your talk. Thank you.
Thank you for the kind introduction, Jared. So I will be speaking, well, I suppose I'll get to the point quickly, but just briefly, I'll be speaking about the outbreak of the Great War, of World War One, in the South Pacific, in the South Pacific region, a story that many are actually not familiar with, and this is part of my PhD research and also part of our project research for our DFAT project, Australian War and Peace 1914 to 1919. This is a particularly interesting story from an Australian perspective, and I will explain why. So a few weeks from now, Australians will be looking towards a place in Western Turkey where their countrymen fought 100 years ago in a war theatre far away from home. The centenary of this most commemorated event in Australian history gives reason to remember those who have fallen, but also to reflect on Australia's participation in the war more generally, and to ask the question about what was at stake from an Australian perspective when Europe went to war in 1914. Thus, I would like to go to the very outbreak of the conflict in August 1914 and focus on events that occurred much closer to Australian shores. The campaign I will explore today, the short Pacific War from August to December 1914, is not even necessarily recognised as such in Australia, yet its legacy lasted until the next major conflict in the region between 1941 and 1945, and is even relevant today. So the photo I would have brought up on the screen, but I will explain, so I might speak for a few minutes longer than I would normally do. The photo I was going to put up on the screen is from the Australian War Memorial, and the Australian War Memorial has all the campaigns on both of its sides of the aisle, all the campaigns that Australians have fought in. So at the very beginning, or at the early stages of Australian war participation in the past, there is South Africa. It says South Africa, for example. It also says China, which means the Boxer Rebellion, which Australians participated in. And then it goes straight to, it says Indian Ocean, which refers to a naval battle between HMAS Sydney, the first real naval victory, Australian naval victory in October 1914, where Sydney destroyed the German cruiser Emden, and then it goes on into Gallipoli and France and Flanders and so forth. So there is no inscription for the Pacific or Pacific War, New Guinea, for example. So it is, we could argue that even the Australian War Memorial does not recognise this as a proper campaign, even though those who have fallen in New Guinea in 1914 are of course, commemorated there. So I will argue that the campaign deserves a more prominent role in our war memories, and even though there was only limited military action, which climaxed in the destruction of the German East Asia Squadron near the Falkland Islands, on the other side in the Atlantic, the naval race for the German Pacific in 1914 gives the story a different, much more significant complexion. In this context, my argument will be that Britain had triggered certain diplomatic and military mechanisms in the area for the benefit of the defence of the British Isles, both before and in the early stages of the war, while leaving the security of the Pacific Ocean exposed to Japanese opportunism. The remaining powers, while engaged, lacked the will or leverage to exert greater influence in the events. So at first, I will just briefly explain a little bit about the geopolitical scene in the South Pacific in 1914. I'll try to do this without a map. So I'll go across the whole region. Well, we have the Australasian dominions in Australia and New Zealand, of course, in the southwestern corner. Then we have the French possessions, which are to this day French, which is French Polynesia and New Caledonia. If we move further up, we have a number of British possessions. We have the British, the Solomon Islands. We have the New Hebrides, which was a condominium between Britain and France. We have German and American Samoa. So Western Samoa was German at the time, which will be relevant to the paper. And American Samoa had been American since 1899. Moving further up, we move to the British Gilbert and Ellis Islands, Fiji, and then we have American Hawaii, Guam, the Philippines. So we have a stretch that was American in 1914, and further up, not in the South Pacific, but there is Japan projecting south through a few tiny islands to the south of Japan. I think that's pretty much all. I hope I haven't forgotten any significant landmass in the area. And we have New Guinea, of course, which is the territory of Papua is Australian since 1906. German New Guinea, just to the north of it, is German. And the eastern part is Dutch, but this is not relevant today. So when World War I broke out in Europe in early August 1914, the belligerents' colonial possessions were drawn into the conflict with immediate effect. Thus, German Samoa... Oh, sorry, I forgot about one significant thing. German Micronesia, which is a vast stretch of islands reaching from the Carolines to the Marshall Islands, Palau to the west, Nauru was part of it. So we have this huge landmass which was not strongly colonized by Germany at the time. There were not many German colonists living in the area, but the landmass, I think, stretched 3,500 kilometers east to west. Essentially between the British possessions and Japan and the American possessions further up north. So when World War I broke out in Europe in 1914, all these possessions were drawn into the war, other than the American ones, of course, as America didn't enter the war in 1914. German Samoa, as well as New Guinea and German Micronesia, were exposed to warfare against mighty Britain, with her dominions in Australia and New Zealand standing loyally on the side of the mother country. So Australia and New Zealand did immediately join the war effort as war broke out in Europe. The British Committee of Imperial Defence prepared the British and Dominion's governments for the case of a conflict in the Pacific before it broke out. Within this framework, and only days into the war, an overseas attack committee was formed in London, setting the primary object as to, I quote, to deprive the enemy of his distant bases and coaling stations, as well as of his wireless stations. So the primary object, strategically speaking, from a British perspective, knock out the wireless stations, knock out communication, knock out the use of the bases as coaling stations, and therefore cut through the German communication channels physically and, wireless. According to this plan, Australia and New Zealand were to assist in the effort by seizing German New Guinea and Yap in the Carolines. That was Australia's task. And German New Guinea, with German Samoa, which was New Zealand's task. So the Overseas Attack Committee defined these two targets. For the Dominions. The German East Asia Squadron, Germany's main naval asset based in Tsingtao in China, was to be destroyed or driven out of the Pacific. Furthermore, the Anglo-Japanese alliance from 1902 provided for Japanese support of Britain in case of crisis. Foreign Secretary Grey was at first reluctant to invoke it, stating politely that Britain, I quote here, should avoid if we could drawing Japan into any trouble. He added, however, that should a case arise in which we needed her help, we would gladly ask for it and be grateful for it. What Gray had in mind in this situation was to was that it should be Britain's initiative to ask for support, not a Japanese initiative to join the war, to enter the war. And this reflected the Foreign Office's understanding that Japan was to be employed, if employed at all, in a geographically limited role defined by Britain. So Britain was to decide whether yes or no, and if yes, Britain was to decide where they would want to employ the Japanese. This is important, or Japan is very important in this context, because of naval power in the region at the time. So I will explain shortly what the proportions were, more or less. So Japan was the most powerful naval power in the Pacific in 1914, with about 257,000 tons of combined warship tonnage. The British Empire in the region had 111,000 tons, so less than half. The Americans had something in between, but they had not entered the war. America was expanding, developing its naval capacity in the region at the time with their two ocean navies, so they were developing a Pacific strategy, but had not gotten there by 1914. So Japan was by far the most powerful naval power in the region, and then there was France with a limited capacity. Japan's early signals concerning the conflict were ambiguous. Foreign Minister Kato emphasized that Japan was not interested in the European conflict, but he also stated that there would be Japanese support if the Germans attacked British possessions in China. Australia and New Zealand had their own views about the Anglo-Japanese alliance. Frederick Eggleston, an influential Australian writer, commented in March 1914 that, quote, "a policy which disregards the Pacific or leaves it to Japan cannot be regarded as a truly imperial policy." Previously, Billy Hughes, Australia's Attorney General at the time and later Prime Minister, had expressed his unease, writing that Australian security depended, quote, "upon the observance and the renewal of the terms of a treaty with a nation whom we have openly humiliated by declining to admit its people on terms of equality with those of other civilized nations." So this refers to the White Australia policy, of course, discriminating the Japanese. New Zealand's mistrust towards Japan is reflected in an article entitled "The Admiralty's Broken Pledge" in the New Zealand Herald from 2 May 1914, which commented on Britain's unwillingness to navally reinforce the South Pacific. The writer scathes that, quote here, "had Japanese protection been hinted at in 1909, which was the Imperial Conference that where it was decided that the Royal Australian Navy was to be established, so had which New Zealand didn't do. New Zealand sponsored ships, but they remained under the Royal Navy. So the writer writes, "had Japanese protection been hinted at in 1909 at the Imperial Conference, New Zealand would have repudiated with indignation that impossible policy and cooperated earnestly with Australia for mutual defence." This is an interesting topic in itself, which I won't further go into today, but there were plans for an Australasian Navy between Australia and New Zealand, but the two countries went in different directions, where Australia did develop an independent Navy and New Zealand did not at the time. The most outspoken group in Britain in favour of invoking Japanese assistance at the outbreak of war was the Admiralty. Hoping to bring all major ships from the Pacific to Europe as quickly as possible, First Lord of the Admiralty Churchill pressed his view upon Prime Minister Asquith, writing to him on 14th of August, so only less than 2 weeks into the war, that Churchill says to his Prime Minister here, "the entry of Japan will of course make the Pacific absolutely safe very soon. Any declaration against entry of Japan into the war would do harm." So he had his very own, Churchill had his very own strategic view of things, where he wanted to get the Germans out of the Pacific, clear the region, and bring the ships that were engaged in the conflict back to Europe as quickly as possible for the British Isles' defence. The Foreign Office, by contrast, had been forewarned by the ambassador to Peking in early August. So the Foreign Office at the time had a different view of things. So he writes to the Foreign Office, the ambassador to China, that is, "I presume that Her Majesty's government have fully considered the probable seizure by Japan of the islands lying between this country and Australia in the event of her declaring war." And this is important. "It seems very advisable that, pending the arrangement of a considerate scheme of cooperation, the Japanese declaration of war should be put forward." So he warns the Foreign Office against bringing Japan into the war because of what he hints at, the uncontrollable consequences this might bring about. Germany, for her own reasons, hoped for Japan's neutrality in a European conflict. When German Foreign Secretary Jago asked his ambassador in Tokyo, Count Rex, in early August about his impressions, the latter replied that, "Should the war be confined to Europe, then Japan would presumably remain neutral." This is his assessment of the situation. He thought the Japanese weren't interested in entering the war. The German government stressed that it did not seek war with Japan and offered a truce in the Pacific and the Far East. The commander of the German East Asian Squadron, Admiral von Spee, at sea in the South Pacific at the outbreak of war, which is one or the reason they weren't taken while they were still in port, so that they were out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and the Allies, Britain above all, didn't really know where they were at the time when the war broke out in August. So von Spee announced that he will not attack British territory in East Asia, even though the pre-war orders had ordered him to interrupt British trade and to attack British ships all over the place. Faced with an overwhelming opposition in the case of Japan's entry into the war, Germany was clearly not on an aggressive footing in the Far East. And this is very easy to explain. As I explained just before, the naval numbers meant that Germany didn't stand a chance at all to survive against a combined British-Japanese war effort, overwhelming. Meanwhile, the tendency in Japan had moved towards war against Germany within a matter of days. What the Japanese required, however, was a British invitation to invoke the treaty. Gray ultimately agreed to a statement that the two and he says, "The two governments are of opinion that action is needed, but only if the action of Japan is not extended to the Pacific Ocean beyond the China Seas." So his official invitation, that's the correspondence between London and Tokyo at the time, confines the invitation to a particular area, which is the China Seas. Japan then issued an ultimatum to Germany on the 15th of August to vacate Tsingtao. Then when this ultimatum lapsed on the 23rd of August, they declared war against Germany. However, neither the ultimatum of the 15th of August nor the declaration of war of the 23rd August mentioned any limitations to Japanese war action. So what had been communicated between Japan and Britain, the Japanese had never agreed that they would limit the action, but that was the British understanding, at least, or wishful thinking, in it might be another interpretation of the correspondence. The Japanese never officially agreed on this, and they never... and it never gets mentioned in the documents of this time. In a parallel development, American opinion became preoccupied with these events. When the Japanese ultimatum of the 15th of August became known in the US, the British ambassador in Washington reported, "Japan's ultimatum to Germany has caused considerable concern. Press charges that Japan has seized opportunity of encroaching upon China, seizing possibly Pacific islands, with minimum of trouble herself. Stresses laid upon danger to U.S. strategic position should islands be occupied. These apprehensions seem to be shared in most circles." So he reports about the Americans being at great unease about the developments, which is understandable because with the U.S. occupied Philippines on one hand and Hawaii and Guam on the other hand, German Micronesia is right in between the two areas. And the Americans knew that if Japan was in between those, there was no hope of holding onto the Philippines if Japan entered a future conflict. so the Americans were very aware of this. Contrasting Kato's, the Japanese primer's reinsurances. Now where am I? I'm still with the U.S. So the U.S. finally agreed, or President Wilson finally decided to pull out of the debate. The Americans had actually suggested that they would launch an initiative, a diplomatic initiative in the Pacific Ocean, neutralize the Pacific Ocean. The British said we're not interested in this. Actually, they weren't interested in any diplomatic meddling. And so it finally trickled. The American initiative trickled out, and as the U.S. was neutral anyway, Wilson decided he wasn't going to pursue this any further. And right, here we go. The Japanese had actually reassured the Americans that they would not seize any territory in the Far East and in the Pacific Ocean, and that's quite significant as well. So the American preoccupation was countered by a Japanese statement where the premier spoke to the American press and publicly said that the Japanese were not interested in territorial expansion. The premier said something different domestically, though, thought something different. So in contrast to these statements, Kato expressed the view that the outbreak of war was an opportunity to sweep up bases in eastern waters and to advance the empire's position in the world, the clearly expansionist view of things. And with hindsight, this is interesting as well, I have Kato's biographer commented that the British invitation was, as he puts it, a godsend for Kato and those who wanted to take Japan into the war. I will say a few words about the early war action. So we have Japan entering the war on the 23rd of August. Britain, Australia, New Zealand are in the war already with French support. So the early war action in the South Pacific was reserved to Britain and the Dominions. Even though Japan had declared war, they weren't participating in it yet. The Imperial War effort was assisted by the French, who had sent out two cruisers under a previously arranged war plan between Britain and France. So this, the possibility of war breaking out between Germany and Britain and France had been discussed in a war plan from February 1914, and they had agreed that they were going to cooperate in the Pacific. So we have Anglo-French cooperation here, as well as in Europe. But they also discussed the Pacific, and they had a war plan for the Pacific, a coordinated one. The earliest action was initiated on the 12th of August when the German wireless station at Yap in the Carolines, which was the main communication hub, actually. So there was a cable from Yap to Shanghai, to Mindanao in the Dutch East Indies, and over to Guam. So Yap and a wireless station, a very powerful wireless station as well. So they knocked out Yap at the very beginning, on the 12th of August. That was the Royal Navy from Hong Kong, actually. Without occupying the island, they didn't occupy the island, they just destroyed the station. German Samoa was seized on the 30th of August, 1914, by a New Zealand expeditionary force, escorted by the Royal Australian Navy, which was now under British command, of course. And little later, on the 11th of September, so we're less than 1.5 months into the war, Australians landed near Rabaul, initiating the seizure of German New Guinea and the Bismarck Archipelago, which took a while, which lasted into December of the same year. But the main German base at Rabaul had been taken by mid-September. But essentially, all German high-powered wireless stations had been dealt with by British, Australian, and New Zealand forces by mid-September. Although the Yap station had actually been repaired by the Germans, as the British had not landed there. Japan had, at the same time, stayed clear of the area, so we're in the middle of September now, and the Japanese have not entered the conflict yet. They have declared war, they have entered the conflict in China, but they have stayed clear of the Pacific. So these early successes, or despite these early successes by the Royal Navy and by Australian and New Zealand forces, it became evident quickly that that the Royal Navy and that the naval assets were overstretched, especially when in September the German squadron, the East Asia squadron, was unaccounted for, so they couldn't find it, they didn't know where it was. Things became clearer in September. I will explain how they did. The uncertainty in, well, British and Australian uncertainty increased dramatically when the British submarine cable at Fanning Island, which is in the far eastern Pacific, not that far from Hawaii, actually, which is where the British ORED cable goes through. So there was a submarine communication cable which went from British Columbia in Canada to via Fanning Island, which was British at the time as well, and via Fiji, Norfolk Island, to Australia and to New Zealand as well. So the Germans cut that in the middle of September, and they also appeared off Samoa in the middle of September. The ones appearing off Fanning Island was a detached unit, actually, while they weren't sailing that fast. But the main bulk of the German squadron appeared in Samoa, which is in the Central Pacific, creating huge uncertainty and even panic to a degree in Australia and in New Zealand, because nobody really knew what the Germans were doing at the time. And I'll get to that in a minute. So I'm in mid-September now. The German position and plan to sail towards South America, which was what was expected, actually. Everyone was thinking the Germans, when Japan enters the war, they will have to sail out, either through the Indian Ocean or around Cape Horn. So the German plans became a bit clearer when the Germans appeared off Tahiti on the 22nd of September 1914, and actually bombarded Papeete. Out of all places, France being the weakest power in the Pacific at the time, but they did bombard Papeete, and would have dawned on planners that the Germans were sailing towards the South American coast and away from central waters or waters nearby Australia at the time. Nevertheless, the uncertainty in the Dominions bound pressure on naval capacity for the upcoming escort duty for the troops going to Europe. So the troops from New Zealand and from Australia were preparing to sail to Europe in September 1914, but the uncertainty actually bound the naval capacity, where especially the New Zealand government insisted on naval escort from New Zealand to Australia, and for Australian naval units then take over to sail over across the Indian Ocean, which the Japanese also assisted in. But it was essentially impossible to do it all at once, and we're only 2 months into the war, which means that Britain relied on Japan very heavily. So the Japanese created two dedicated South Sea squadrons, the first of which was sent out on the 14th of September, tasked with searching German Micronesia for the German squadron and destroying the wireless station in the area. The second squadron joined the effort in the beginning of October. Meanwhile, some British and Australian warships were cruising around Fiji in search of the German squadron, whereas others were preparing for the troop convoys. And this strategy was in tune with Admiralty arrangements with Japan, dividing the search area between the Australian and Japanese naval forces along the equator. So the Admiralty had, I have a letter from the middle of October, but I'm sure these arrangements were made in September, where the Admiralty asks the Japanese to search north of the equator in two search areas. All of German Micronesia is north of the equator, and says that the Australian forces will patrol south of the equator, which is essentially New Guinea, and to the east, Fiji, for example, which I just mentioned. They essentially carved up the Pacific in search of the German squadron. And they did this in operational terms between themselves and the Japanese Navy. So what happened afterwards, and we're in October 1914 now, the Japanese South Sea squadrons occupied the German Marshall Islands, which was followed by Yap in the Carolines, in the Eastern Carolines, and by Truk in the Western Carolines. So they were tasked, if we will, by the Admiralty to search for the German squadron and to knock out the wireless stations, but at the same time they actually occupied German Micronesia. So they had essentially occupied all of German Micronesia, all of these islands that I mentioned, the Caroline Islands, Eastern Western Caroline Islands, the Marshall Islands, and Palau by the middle of October 1914. So the question was, what next? What is to happen next? It became clear that the removal of Japanese forces from the seized islands was not a desirable object in London. The Admiralty wrote to, and I will have to explain that, because the initial war plan was for Australian forces to sail up north once they had taken German New Guinea, and then take the essential islands in German Micronesia, so Yap, the Marshall Islands, Jeluit, knock out the wireless stations, occupy it, which took much longer than expected because of the overstretch and because of the troop transports. So Australia was preparing to sail further, which was delayed all the time by these various factors. But the Admiralty developed a different take on these things. So the Admiralty said in October 1914 that the Japanese government may be asked for continued occupation of Yap by their forces. This was relating to Yap in the eastern Carolines, while the Australian government, not being kept informed by London, was still expecting to send a force to German Micronesia to relieve the Japanese, Churchill wrote in all bluntness, the Admiralty would strongly deprecate any action towards Japan that would appear suspicious or ungracious. We are deriving benefit from their generous aid. They have intimated that their occupation is purely military and devoid of political significance. And there, I trust, we may leave the matter for the present. So he wanted to leave it things as they are, Japanese assistance in the Pacific, and no political implications, just let them keep German Micronesia once they had taken it. A similar view was expressed by Green, the British ambassador in Tokyo. He cabled, it appears to me it would be at once politic and graceful if we offered them some signal mark of our confidence, without alarming American and Australian sentiment, to refrain from requesting at the present juncture the transfer to Great Britain of any islands which Japan may occupy for strategic reasons. So here we see a certain convergence of positions between the Foreign Office and between the Admiralty. The Admiralty had been the driving force to subordinate everything under naval strategy without consideration for the Dominion's position, for the Dominion's preoccupations. Churchill brushed over these things, and he had his own British Islands defense in mind. So we have October 1914, where these two positions converge. It is consistent with this storyline of misunderstanding and miscommunication that the Australian government actually went ahead and prepared an expedition in November 1914 to relieve the Japanese in the islands north of the equator. And this was called off by Colonial Secretary Harcourt in the following words. So he writes to Australia and asks them not to go north of the equator, stay in New Guinea, take the rest of the islands, the other islands, and not create too many political waves surrounding the subject. So he says, we consider it most convenient for strategic reasons to allow them to remain in occupation for the present, leaving the whole question of the future to be settled at the end of the war. So he essentially wants silence around the subject. That's what he says to the Australian government. So he asks them, if therefore the Australian exhibition would confine itself to the occupation of the German islands south of the equator, we should be glad. We have a juxtaposition here of imperial strategy versus Dominion's sub-imperial strategy, which do clash. The imperial strategy prevails. How predetermined the Japanese occupation of the German Micronesia was at the time is difficult to assess. There are hints, of course. It seems as though an escalating process of growing naval necessity by Britain was met by a parallel process of growing military preparedness and imperial appetite in Japan. This is corroborated by a cable from Great Green in Tokyo, so the foreign minister writes. He claims that the Anglo-Japanese naval cooperation has led by common agreement and desire to the occupation of various points for strategic purposes, as if it wasn't pre-planned, but operational necessity led to the situation which we have. That's his argument. Ultimately, however, Kato in Japan claimed that operations in the Pacific had been much more excessive than had at first been intended, and that Japanese had been obliged to enlarge these operations in the southern seas. he also says when clarifying the situation between Britain and Japan, there was no agreement, but there were discussions. So he wrote, so the Japanese wrote to Britain at the time, Britain should bear in mind it will not be possible for the Japanese government to abandon and hand over the islands in question to another power when the time comes for considering final terms of peace. Kato here says, we're here, we're going to stay here. We're in November 1914 now, and towards the end of the year. So we have the division of the Pacific along the equator. Australia and New Zealand and Britain through them have installed themselves in New Guinea, in Samoa, in a portion of the Solomon Islands, which was German at the time. The Japanese are north of the equator. And when the dust began to settle around this situation, Harcourt wrote an apologetic letter to Australia, which was labelled very secret. So he writes to the Governor General of Australia. He admits that, I'm quoting here, Britain could not spare enough in 1914 to deal with the Pacific. He admits that the Pacific was not of very high on the British strategic agenda at the time. He openly admits to it, even though this is a secret and personal letter. He then advises the Governor-General to Australia to, in the most gradual and diplomatic way, to begin prepare the mind of your ministers, that's the Australian government, for the possibility that at the end of the war, Japan may be left in possession of the Northern Islands, and we with everything south of the equator. He then continues, as a consolation almost, he writes, it will be a great gain to add a German New Guinea to Papua and to have the whole of the Solomon Islands under the British flag. He essentially asks the Governor General to prepare Australia for a deal with Japan, if we will, certainly an agreement or the acceptance of the fact that Japan will stay in German Micronesia. And what this created were seeds of mistrust between the Australasian dominions and London over this question. And this even led, that's in early 1915 now, to Australian suspicion towards Britain, that there was some secret deal, some secret under-the-table deal between Britain and Japan, where they, well, I'm quoting here now, and the Colonial Secretary Harcourt then writes back, denies that there was any secret deal. He says, a secret agreement with the Japanese government in relation to the eventual disposal of the late German islands north of the equator has not been made. So we can see that the confidence had, that Australian and New Zealand confidence towards the British position was shattered in a way, because Australia was not kept in the loop, because the dealings were made between London and Tokyo. Eventually the Australians were informed, of course, but that was after the fact. So in conclusion of this story, the Great War was only a few months old by this stage, but Japan had already seized the moment of British naval weakness and overstretch to remove an inferior Germany from the South Pacific, and had in the process quietly turned provisional occupations into permanent ones, having prioritized home waters defense over Australian and New Zealand geostrategic concerns or American uneasiness. Britain had continued on a trajectory of strategic withdrawal, which had been initiated before the war, actually, to pull ships out of the Pacific Ocean. But we can see this in the same context of downgrading the strategic importance of the Pacific region in British strategic thinking. That's why Japan was brought into the whole constellation as an ally. Japan, at the same time, had gained control of significant portions of the Pacific Ocean. During this process, the young Australian Commonwealth had received a sobering reality check with regard to its geostrategic remoteness from Britain and its future security. The various movements of the time from August to November 1914 then consolidated into an informal territorial agreement, which was in 1917. So the agreement that the British were accused of was actually made, even though Australia was kept in the loop at the time. That was in 1917. But more importantly, this translated into the Versailles Peace Treaty, with its mandate system in the aftermath of the war, which actually carved up the Pacific along the exact same lines which the outbreak of the war had established. And this created a drastically changed security landscape in the area and serious ramifications for the next conflict, which was the Second World War and the Pacific War, as we know it in name. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Bart Zielinski for that fine presentation. So we come to questions and discussion, and we've got 25 minutes or 20 minutes or so. So you've spoken about how Japan came out of the events of the final months of 1914. What would have happened if the Germans had prevailed in 1918? Now, this is slightly off your paper, but you've looked at this material. I mean, what would have been the outlook for Australia and New Zealand, the region, of a German victory in 1918 or thereabouts? What would the implication have been in view of what had happened to Germany in those early years of the war in the South Pacific? Talk to the end.
Well, thanks for this question. It's actually a very interesting and a good one, and it is also a question that was picked up by the war strategists at the time in Britain. So the agreements about the end of the war, about the North-South divide, about Japan staying where they are, and Australia and New Zealand as well, was made in Britain on the condition that Britain would win the war, or at least not lose the war, something in between. So, everyone was quite aware that the war was going to be a victor's war, and it was. But this question is actually unpredictable: what the Germans were going to do to the South Pacific. There is clear German interest in Africa all the time, and the Germans are actually remain in East Africa well into the war. There are no documents, no German documents that I have come across what Germany was going to do with the South Pacific. The South Pacific was actually a region that the Germans, when they had lost, were prepared to let go first rather than Africa. But it is essentially impossible to me at least, to answer the question what the colonial arrangement had been if Germany had utterly crushed Britain during the war. We can imagine an African solution. I can presume the trade interest was more in China than in the South Pacific. And the New Zealand Prime Minister has actually said in 1921, after the war, well, had we lost the war, who knows under which flag or which flag would be flying now over New Zealand. There were preoccupations, but I think we cannot clearly say whether the Germans would have made an entry, politically speaking and militarily speaking, into the South Pacific, because the South Pacific was certainly not their top priority, as we can tell by many different factors. The level of colonization, the level of military expenditure for the South Pacific had not been high in within the German colonial system. So I'm not sure what would have happened, but there would have certainly been a detrimental colonial arrangement if Britain had lost the war.
Right, there's a question here. Yes.
I have a question. How big was the German flotilla there in
So the question is, how big was the German flotilla?
Yeah, the German flotilla essentially consisted of two armoured cruisers. I'm trying to think of the naval tonnage now, compared to Britain. So there were a few destroyers. There were a few light cruisers, which Emden was one of. The two main armoured cruisers were Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, which... I think the German naval tonnage was about one third of the British tonnage, and about into the 40,000 tons, I believe. And one significant thing about the German flotilla and about the Australian or British presence is that the main warship, British warship in the area, HMAS Australia, was by far stronger than the two armoured cruisers. So if the two armoured cruisers had met the Australia, HMAS Australia, the Australian battle cruiser, they would have been destroyed. And that's why they were actually driven out to the south, to South America. Nevertheless, the Germans were powerful enough to deal with a lot of many other naval assets below the strength of the battle cruiser. And this came out at the Battle of Coronel, which was in early November 1914, where they encountered a British flotilla of Coronel of the Chilean coast, which was destroyed. So the British had to send much more powerful naval assets into the area to deal with the Germans, which then happened around Cape Horn and the Falkland Islands. This is where the two naval forces met, and this is where the German flotilla was destroyed.
Okay, so question down there. Don't stand in front of the camera, yes? Yeah.
Just with regard to the American interests and their strategy that you referred to, have you seen anything in relation to their capacity to have gone into Micronesia and done, I guess, similar, and therefore chose not to, or did they not have the capacity to go into Micronesia?
Who's this?
So the United States have the capacity to go into Micronesia or not? Why didn't they go there is the question, the United States?
They certainly have a naval capacity to participate in the war, but this question actually doesn't even arise. So, well, I think there might be a few things that have to be understood. First of all, the Americans were building up their Pacific Ocean, their Pacific Navy. So their term of thinking was two ocean navy. They had most of their assets in the Atlantic Ocean at the time. The Panama Canal had just been opened in July 1914. It wasn't fully operational, though, so they couldn't easily get the ships back and forth. So they were unwilling to participate in a war for that reason, and they were also unwilling because the political Americans didn't want to enter the war, actually, and Wilson was quite confident in American neutrality, so he wasn't interested in exposing America to warfare, which was, from American perspective, unnecessary. That's what it was regarded at the time. Japan at the time was not regarded. There is yellow peril and these racial discussions, but Japan at the time was not considered an imminent threat. The Japanese, the American war plans were preparing for a possible war with Japan. That was American naval thinking, but the political circles were certainly not going down that line at that stage.
Okay, there's a question down there. Andrew, yeah, don't stand in front of the camera, Andrew. No, stay down. Yep, go on. Yes, go on. Yes. Yes, Andrew, don't stand.
Don't stand. Right. If I could just perhaps ask you a couple of questions.
That'll be quick.
What you told us. Perhaps one should look before World War One to the attitude of the Prime Ministers of Australia, Deakin and Fisher, who realised that the Royal Navy would be extremely stretched dealing with the German Navy in the North Sea. And they were therefore extremely keen, as was the Australian Parliament, building its own navy. Huh. The Admiralty under Lord
Fisher. No, Andrew, we're not going to pick all this up on the podcast. So you're saying that.
The question is, yep, simply the deterrence created by the Australian fleet was much more important than a lot of people think.
Mm-hmm. So the suggestion of the early Australian Prime Ministers Deakin and Fisher to set up our own navy became an important deterrent, yes, which is probably more significant than a lot of people thought at the time or subsequently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, and well, I can say that this is true indeed, because and as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the German command, the German naval command on the ground in the Pacific, which was von Spee at the time, was very aware that his squadron didn't stand a chance against HMAS Australia, and it is politically. I think this is quite complicated because the the premise in 19 at the Royal at the Imperial Conference to establish a Royal Australian Navy was that a Royal Australian Navy would always be under Royal Navy command if war broke out. So it was a single standing navy in terms of peace, but it had always been clear that it was going to be a British commanded navy in times of war. Nevertheless, we can assume that since the Australian Navy had been paid for by Australia, it would have been politically very, very difficult for the British to withdraw warships from Australian waters, from the Pacific, if the Pacific had not been pacified and gotten rid of the Germans. So I think the political relationship between Britain and Australia played into this, where the ships actually remained in Australian waters, where HMS Australia remained in Australian waters or in Pacific waters as a deterrent, and essentially guaranteed that the Germans did not come anywhere near Australian waters, which they never did in this conflict in 1914.
Just following Admiral Robertson's question, so what did this remind us again, what did the New Zealanders come up with in 1914? What? Very little by way of naval presence.
Well, the naval presence was essentially non-existent, other than one training ship, one cruiser training ship. They had the New Zealanders had funded HMS New Zealand, but and it made a tour to the Pacific before the war, but it wasn't fighting in the Pacific during the war. And because which is a significant asset, it was a battle cruiser just like HMS Australia. So the two ships would have probably, that's what I assume, if there was another ship, if there was a New Zealand ship, another battle cruiser, that would have made a big difference because the overstretch would have been limited and they would have had two huge cruisers which could have both tackled the German squadron to shuffle around with, but they didn't.
So where was HMAS? HMS New Zealand?
In European waters.
In European waters.
Under Admiralty Command.
Oh, right. There's a question down there? Yes.
Could you describe for us a bit more about the progress of the Australian takeover in German New Guinea? What assets, German assets, were there to be taken, and what numbers of Germans were present, and what level of resistance occurred?
Question about the Australian takeover in German New Guinea. What assets were there and what were taken?
Well, there was no military force in German New Guinea, as there was no military force, properly speaking, in any of the German possessions. So there was a mixed troop of native police and a few German officers on the ground who resisted. I'd have to think what the numbers were, but it was certainly less than 100 German. I can't think now. It would have been around 30 or 40 German troops, I believe. So no significant military assets at all. Nevertheless, the warfare that broke out in September when Australians landed near Rabaul, the most significant asset to be taken out was the wireless station. They were going straight to the wireless station. This was actually why they didn't land in Rabaul, but a bit further down after Kokopo, after Herbertshöhe is the German name, and then they marched straight towards the wireless station in Vitapaka, and that's where six Australian troops were lost. So the first Australian war casualties were actually in New Guinea, other than an Australian submarine that the AE-1, which sank patrolling around New Guinea waters. But that was not, properly speaking, a war casualty, at least not in battle. This was not a battle casualty. But six Australian troops did die in battle, taking over or marching towards the wireless station, being opposed by the Germans at the time. And the Australian force wasn't very numerous either. There were, I think, 500 troops were sent altogether, but the first contingents that were actually landed to take the wireless station were, I think, 20 troops and then another 20. So we can imagine an ambush where a few lives were actually lost.
Question down the back. Yes?
Was Japan considered to be a junior partner in all of this? Number one, was Japan considered to be a junior partner in the naval warfare, and number two, who probably was calling the shots down in this South Pacific area.
So was Japan considered to be
a junior partner
in 1914, and who was calling the shots in the region?
Well, this is probably the great misunderstanding that occurred at the time, that Japan was considered a junior partner in the whole campaign, but never saw itself as a junior partner. And this is also why the Japanese always refused to publicly say that they were going to confine their efforts to a particular area, that they weren't going to enter the war fully. The Japanese had always been saying, if we enter the war, we enter the war fully and totally and with all our commitment. So in this respect, they were a junior partner in global terms, because the Pacific Ocean effort the Pacific Ocean wasn't a major battleground if we look to Europe, of course. But within this very confined context, I would argue that they were seen as a junior partner, but never saw themselves as a junior partner, never said that they were going to be a junior partner, and that that all the misunderstanding that occurred between Britain and Japan at the time stems from this miscommunication, where Britain was reading more into the relationship than the Japanese were ready to admit. And your second question was,
who ultimately called the shots down in this?
Initially, Britain called all the shots because Britain invited Japan into the war. So in terms of diplomatic initiative, we would have to blame Britain.
Why not? Okay. So have I missed anyone? There's a question here.
In view of the way Japan was treated by the Allies in the First World War, do you see any correlation to their actions in the 30s when they took over Manchuria and then invaded China and that sort of thing? Did that play on their ego, collective ego, let's say?
Yeah, well, this is difficult because this is reading events with hindsight. So we can think, of course, looking into the 30s and even more looking into the 40s, that this was bound to happen. I wouldn't go as far as saying that this was bound to happen, but there was certainly a Japanese expansionist spirit in the leadership. It is very difficult to read the Japanese leadership and its workings, because there is a naval component to it, there is an army component to it. So the army component would have driven Japanese politics expansion towards China, towards the mainland. The naval component, did drive the Japanese expansionism into the seas, into the island world, and the political leadership is somewhere in between. But we can certainly say that that the prime minister, that Kato, certainly was keen on expansionism, and as his biographer wrote, that he had taken the opportunity of taking Japan into the war. So there were political dealings in Japan at the time that were keen on going into war. And if we continue the story into the 1930s, this expansionist drive spirit had prevailed in Japanese politics over time.
It's a question here. We've got to be quick on the question here. Yes?
With the fleet numbers you mentioned at the start of the war, you didn't mention the Russians. Did they have anything left in the Far East after the Japs had bashed them?
So what were the Russians up to in 1914?
I haven't included them in my chart that I would have had there, and I haven't checked their numbers as I checked the numbers of belligerents in 1914 plus America. However, they were a negligible quantity after 1905, after Tsushima, after they had lost their Pacific fleet to the Japanese. So strategically speaking, they had abandoned the Pacific Ocean under 1905 and were not a quantity that was to be reckoned with at the time.
Yep.
Yes, I just heard recently that at the end of the First World War, Billy Hughes had to stand up for the Australian right to have New Guinea rather than it being ceded to the German New Guinea, rather than it being ceded to the Japanese. How real was the threat that the Japanese would be?
So the question is, the Australian Prime Minister stood up in 1918 at Versailles against, or having stood up against the Germans, also didn't want the Japanese to take over German New Guinea.
Yes. that's right.
There was never a question of Japan taking over German New Guinea. Okay. That was never, no. Actually, the Japanese leadership at the time, and this is from sources from early to mid-1918, as far as I remember, the Japanese were quite prescient about what was going to happen, which is quite amazing because quite interesting because this sort of foreshadowed about what was happening at Versailles. So they essentially, the Japanese left the diplomatic initiative when the signs were pointing towards a British war victory, left the diplomatic initiative about the South Pacific to Britain because of their certainty that that Britain and Australia and New Zealand under its umbrella would not give away German New Guinea and German Samoa. So this had been clear to the Japanese leadership. This is from sources that I remember from 1918, which meant that this was the, in terms of political, diplomatic, international arrangements, this would give the Japanese leverage to say, if we keep this, we keep this. And this was essentially what happened later on. And Hughes, towards the conference, Hughes' position was that, Hughes actually tried to get Britain to get the Japanese out of Micronesia, which was never realistic. But Hughes was certainly, one of his main, or his main negotiation strategy for Versailles was to keep German New Guinea. And the Japanese were playing with this and making this, turning this in favour of their own keeping of German Micronesia, but there was never talk of them taking anything else than the islands north of the equator.
Just a final question on Billy Hughes. As you know, he was probably the only Australian politician in the 30s who was opposed to appeasement, and so he was opposed to appeasement in the 30s. As early as the end of the First World War, he was very concerned about Japan. Now, of the documents you've read, what's your interpretation of what Billy Hughes was up to? Was he very perceptive? Was it a bit of luck? Was he prejudiced? I mean, how did he come to those conclusions? What did you find about Hughes in the archives that you've read?
His thinking about...
Yeah, about the region, about security.
I remember one source in which, where Hughes said or wrote, he was certainly very keen, very defensive of Australian interest in the region, and very vociferous at the conference for Australia to have a geopolitical, geostrategic buffer in the region. So whether Australia could have even realistically navally secured more than German New Guinea is quite debatable and was debated in Australia at the time. But one of the interesting things he said was something along the lines that Australia is a very scarcely populated country with a population of 5 million only at the time. He said something along the lines, how can we pretend to be in a position to keep, to claim these lands to ourselves without, and this was partly in tune with the Yellow Peril discourse at the time, how can we pretend to be able to keep these lands against, I don't remember how he formulated it, against the Yellow Hordes from China and from Japan. But his answer seems to have been, not through cooperation, but through confrontation, through Australian interest at certain borders and naval protection. So the way I read Hughes at the time was, and he said this in Versailles actually, he said, in French, j'y suis, j'y reste, so we are here and we stay here. And and they created this buffer close to the Australian mainland, which they would never give away at the conference.
Many thanks. So thanks to Bert Zielinski, who speaks English, obviously, but also German and French, and so is in a great position to read the documentation around the period of 1418 and before that and after it. So it's great to have you here today to give you a perspective about Germany and Australia and the Southwest Pacific in 1418. And your other insights into our politicians at the time, having read the documents in Australia, New Zealand, in Germany and Britain and other places as well, in Paris as well. Now, good luck with your studies for your PhD. I'm sure that they'll bear fruit, and we'd love to have you back to talk about this in the future as we're currently in the centenary of the First World War. But for tonight, thanks for a good performance and a fine presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.